Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
It is good to see everyone here this evening. If you would turn to Genesis 22, we'll begin there in just a moment as we continue this series through Abraham. I do want to mention, as was already announced this morning, we had a tremendous group that spent the weekend at Lads to Leaders at the convention at the Opryland Hotel, and I told my class earlier this morning that you would be able to find out who participated just by looking for people who seem to have walked between 15 and 20 miles in the last 2 days. Because that's essentially what happens when you're at the convention. But we had so many students that participated in so many different ways. We had so many adults who volunteered to help. And then Dwayne and Glenna Folks did a tremendous job coordinating that as they've done several years. And so we just had a wonderful, wonderful time. And what I really appreciated about it was just not necessarily the competing or whatever else, although there were some awards that were won, and that's always an exciting thing. But what was really special was seeing the way that our young people were spending time together, to see the way they had prepared, whether it was to do a puppet skit that had a good message, or to participate in the debate, or the Bible Bowl, or the scripture reading, or song leading, or giving a speech. I mean, there were so many ways they participated, and you saw that there was a lot of work that went into that. And I just think that's a tremendous, tremendous thing that they did. And so we want to congratulate all of those who were involved in that. That was a wonderful thing to be part of. We also kind of keep in mind some of the ways we have to be involved here coming up. One that we'll be starting pretty soon is our marriage mentoring program. And I know we've talked a lot about that. I will just throw out this encouragement. Right now, we could use some more mentees. We have some mentors. We don't have maybe as many mentees. You don't have to have been just married for a couple of years to qualify for this. You know, you can have been married for a while, but still want to spend time with another couple and get some advice, and it's helpful for both couples that spend time doing that. We'll get started with that soon, and so if you've signed up, be looking for some announcements. Also, you've probably noticed as you pulled in that we do have some additional signs in our parking lot on either side of the building. And on this side, as you pull in, you've noticed there are some additional handicap spaces that were added. We also have some guest parking spaces. We had 7, now we've raised that to 10. So we have 10 spots that are right near the building, and we're really going to do our best to reserve those for our guests. When we were growing up, if we had people over at our house, once I got old enough to drive, I had a job that I had to do, and that is back both of our cars out of the driveway where we lived and park them on the side of the street so that our guests that were coming in could pull in to the driveway. You probably do something similar when you have people over. There's something about inviting someone and you want to make room for them. Well, essentially that's what we're trying to do with these parking spots specifically for our guests. We want to invite people to be part of our worship. And when we do that, we want to have a place for them. And we want them to know that that place is open. And so, let me encourage you. I know it'll be tempting, especially if it's just 5 minutes before worship and there are 5 guest spots that just look so inviting. I'm going to encourage you to resist that temptation. Because those who visit a worship service usually come right about the time it starts. And so it may be that they even arrive late, and we want to have a spot for them. We also have some additional senior parking as well, and then some additional handicap spaces on this side. What we're trying to do is just trying to facilitate some things that will help us as we grow, and that also will help those who need to be close to the building be able to be close to the building. And so that's what we're trying to do. Just wanted to make you aware of that as you've seen those being in the works for the last few weeks. Before we begin Genesis 22 and thinking about the next chapter in the life of Abraham, we're going to sing one of our newer songs that I think is very fitting, especially when we think of this chapter. God will make a way. God will make a way. where there seems to be no way. He works in ways we cannot see. He will make a way for me. He will be my guide. Hold me closely to His side. With love and strength for each new day, He will make a way. He will make a way. And God will make a way where there seems to be no way. He works in ways we cannot see. He will make a way for me. And He will be my guide. Hold me closely to His side. With love and strength for each new day, He will make a way. He will make a way. If you would please be opening up to Genesis 22. Genesis 22, and I don't know if you like riddles. That's something that I really enjoyed growing up. Riddles, and you try to solve exactly what they meant. Sometimes it would be wordplay. Sometimes it would be something that was really complicated to try to think through. Here's one that I heard a few years ago, and you may have heard it before. What is greater than God, more evil than the devil? The poor have it, the rich want it, and if you eat it, you will die. Now just look at that and just take a second or two to think about it. Now, if you've never heard this before, the answer is nothing. That there's nothing greater than God, nothing more evil than Satan, and then you think about those who have nothing, those who don't, and then if you eat nothing, you will die. It's kind of a clever play on words. But what I wanted us to think about was that first assertion, the idea that there is nothing or no one that's greater than God. Because as Christians, that's the attitude that we are supposed to have every day. That's the mindset we're supposed to be displaying. And yet I wonder sometimes how easy that is for us to maintain. This idea that there is nothing greater, there is nothing more important than my service to God, that He is the supreme ruler of my life. I think about that especially in light of even recent events. You may have seen on the news last week kind of a national media firestorm around a simple ad that featured Tiger Woods there as he was kind of lining up a putt, and he just recently won a golf tournament, and Nike ran an ad where the tagline was, "Winning takes care of everything." And that created a controversy. It created a controversy because people were thinking back towards the incidents in his past and the affairs and what had taken place and everything personally that had happened in his life and how that affected his game. And I realize that a company is not trying to make a moral statement probably as much as just make some money and get some publicity and notoriety. And I realize that we watch athletes participate and we understand that we watch sports, but no, there are some things going on in personal lives that aren't good and that we wouldn't necessarily agree with in many cases. I'm not thinking about either of those things. What I'm thinking about is the statement itself, the idea that sort of winning takes care of everything. In other words, if I feel like I'm on top, if I feel like I'm victorious, then everything else should be taken care of. But that's the focus. And on a sports level, there's a sense in which, if you're playing on a team or even individually, there's some truth to that. On a sporting level, if a basketball team starts winning, all of a sudden it's easier for the players to get along. And if a football team starts winning, all of a sudden the coach looks a lot smarter. It looks like even though he might have had the same game plan and they just couldn't execute it, now all of a sudden when they can, everybody starts to feel better about themselves, things start to look better. There's a sense in which winning takes care of a lot of those things. But there's another sense in which there'll come a time when any athlete that's playing a game will no longer be able to play. When anyone who's competing will no longer be able to compete. So at that point, will winning still be everything? Will it still solve all your problems? What if that goes away? What if you don't have that?
And we can apply that to any aspect of our lives, because even if it's out of the realm of an actual competition, don't we feel like if we're on top, if we've achieved something, then that takes care of everything else? In that backdrop of sort of where we live, kind of the cultural air that we breathe, I think it's fascinating to see what God calls Abraham to do more than once, but what He calls him to do again in Genesis 22. And that is exactly the opposite of seeking achievement or seeking something for himself. He's calling Abraham to take something he's been given, his tremendous blessing that he's been waiting for and waiting for and waiting for, and to give that up. Do we really believe that nothing is greater than God, that nothing is more important than our relationship with Him? It sounds like a strange story, a strange passage. And it's difficult because we're going to find out as we read Genesis 22 that it's a test. That Abraham is facing a test. And sometimes we have very negative connotations that can come along with that. You may not have liked tests growing up. If you were a student, teachers, you may not like giving tests. But we understand there is a point when a test is given that the hope is that the student will be able to display what he or she has learned. In other words, even if it feels like a teacher is really trying to give you a test to trap you and to try to make you feel badly, the point is to be able to display what you've learned so that you can grow. You may have heard the old joke before about the individual who was in class and he was cheating off of another student, and the teacher finally called him in and he said, "I know you've been cheating off this person that sits up front, sits in front of you." And the student was defensive and he said, "Well, how do you know that?" The teacher said, "I set your test side by side and you have the same exact answers." He said, "Well, that could just be coincidence. You know, just because he wrote down the letter A and I wrote down the letter A, or he chose C and I chose C, that, you know, it's just a coincidence. It just so happens that side by side, we had the same answers." And the teacher said, "Yeah, but when we got down to the bottom at a discussion question, he wrote, 'I don't know,' and you wrote, 'Me either.' And so that kind of gave it away. You know, if you do that, it becomes a little more obvious." You see, we might not like tests. We may even try to figure out ways around tests, but the end result of Scripture is that those who follow God will have times of testing. And as we think about that, we're going to dig in a little more to what that really means, and especially what we see in Abraham's life. But I want us to set the stage with what's happened in chapter 21. When we last left, Abraham and Sarah, they had not yet had Isaac. The birth had been predicted. It was coming shortly. Sodom and Gomorrah had been destroyed. Lot and his daughters were allowed to escape, although Lot's life would never be the same. And in chapter 21, we find the realization to God's promise that Isaac is born. His name means laughter, and we're reminded of the laughter of Sarah when she thought, "Could I have a child at this age?" And we also see that there's something else that takes place. There's more tension between Hagar and Ishmael. In fact, Sarah becomes very jealous because of Ishmael's attitude towards Isaac. Hagar was Sarah's servant, and we remember that when they were trying to rush God's answer to the promise, Abram and Hagar had Ishmael. So Ishmael is the older brother, in a sense, and yet Isaac is the son of promise. And you can imagine the tension there. Eventually, Hagar and Ishmael are sent away, and yet God takes care of them. God sustains them. And then we see something we studied about a couple of months ago now, when Abraham makes the same mistake with a ruler named Abimelech that he made with Pharaoh, and that is lying about his relationship with Sarah. And we see the results of that as well. And it's with all of those things in the background that we come to Genesis 22. And we'll begin reading in verse 1. "Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, 'Abraham.' And he said, 'Here I am.' He said, 'Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you.' So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac, his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering, and he arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over here, and we will worship and return to you." Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told them. And Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked. And behold, behind him, a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide," as it is said to this day, "In the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." This is without a doubt one of the most well-known passages in the Old Testament. Probably one of the most well-known, if not the most well-known incident in Abraham's life. It's difficult for us to even wrap our minds around how something like this would take place. And there have been artists through the years that have tried to capture what happened on this scene. And I have just a few of them to share, but it's difficult for us even to picture what it would have been like. As they depict Abraham there holding the knife and the angel. The next one is Rembrandt's rendering of this scene. Notice the way Abraham's covering Isaac's eyes. Or the next one has been also very well known and used, as you have an individual who's taking a knife. It's such a cruel picture for us to try to envision. And yet in Genesis 22, that's what we see. If you notice at the very beginning, when God describes Isaac in those first few verses of Genesis 22, He says, "Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac." I don't believe that God is trying to rub anything in here to Abraham. I believe this is a description of who Isaac was. Isaac was the son of promise. He wasn't Abraham's only son. We've seen that Ishmael has already been born. After Sarah dies, Abraham is going to marry Keturah. They're going to have more children. So it's not that this is his only son or his only child, but this is the son of promise. In fact, in Hebrews 11, the Hebrews author would say this was his only begotten son. Isn't that an interesting phrase? This is the son of promise. They had been waiting for this and waiting for this. Just imagine how happy they would have been when finally he was born. And it had to have been the work of God, because Abraham's 100 and Sarah's 90. And now God is asking Abraham to give up that promise. Can you imagine what would have been going through his mind? It's hard even as a parent to think about that, to think about what that would have been like. It's hard to imagine what it would be like to make that walk with a son that's carrying the wood for the altar in which you were going to fulfill this command. I sometimes wonder what would have gone through his mind. Was he thinking about some childhood memories? Was he thinking about what it was like when he took his first steps, when he started walking, when he started growing? I mean, how do you even wrap your mind around this? We see some glimpses that Scripture gives us into what Abraham was thinking. But I want us just to let the enormity of this request, of this test, sink in. This is serious. And it's a little difficult for us in our culture that might be far removed from where Abraham was to imagine the importance of the social status of your line of descendants. Not only was this something that God had continued to promise Abraham over and over again, but this was something that is how you measured yourself socially against other families, against other nations. This was important. This was a lot to give up, if you think about what it would have meant. When we read in the New Testament, James tells us in James 1 and verse 13 that God doesn't tempt anyone. In fact, James tells us that we're led away by our own lust, and that's how we wind up in temptation, that's how we wind up in sin. But we do see here that God tested Abraham. It's interesting to see this term that's used here for testing is used in more than one place to describe testing of a servant of God. In fact, in Exodus chapter 20, when God makes His presence known with this fierce storm of thunder and lightning at the giving of the Ten Commandments, Moses says that God did that to test them. And that the result of the test in that passage was Moses wanted to see if the fear of God was in them. That's what God was trying to find out. Was the fear of God in them? Later on in Deuteronomy 8, in verse 2, we'll read about the wandering of the Israelites, and that's described as a test. So there are times of testing that are going to come if we follow God. And yet Abraham responds to this test with obedience. There's so much about this that we don't know. And even though the text, as we're reading, it slows down and sort of gives us a little more details as they get closer to the place of the offering, we don't know how Isaac reacted. It seems that he didn't resist or that he didn't put up much of a fight. At least we don't read that, but we don't know. We don't know exactly what the servants would have thought when they went over to worship. There's so much that we don't know, but I think that if we just focus on some of the importance symbolically and some of the importance we see here physically with what Abraham did, we can gain some very rich blessings. We know the end of the story. We know what happens as Abraham raises the knife. We know that God is going to intervene. And this message from an angel of the Lord, which we've looked at, there are times when an individual described as the angel of the Lord seems to speak on behalf of God, or seems to speak as God, and that's what happens here. Because the angel of the Lord says, "You have not withheld Isaac from me." And so you get this idea that God is not going to let this happen, that as Abraham raises the knife, though he doesn't know that, and then to see the ram that was there, that God had provided. Have you ever wondered if while Abraham and Isaac were walking to that place of sacrifice, while they were getting on their journey with their servants, somewhere God was preparing a ram. Somewhere there was a ram walking around that was going to end up in that place due to the guidance of God. They didn't know about it, but God did. God had that in mind. We don't know what Isaac's response was after this to Abraham. In fact, we don't get a lot of interaction between Isaac and Abraham, at least verbally, in the chapters after this. We don't see a lot of what Sarah and Abraham say after this. And so there are a lot of details we might wish we had. But as we think about what God has demanded here in the sacrifice, and maybe we ask some questions and maybe we wonder, I think there are a couple of principles that arise from this. Obviously, there are many lessons we could learn, but I think here we see Abraham doing a couple of things. Number one, I believe we see Abraham learning from his past. This is before the law that the Israelites are given. This is before the many times we'll read in the Old Testament where God would have in the sacrifice the firstborn high on the list of priorities. That if you were going to offer a sacrifice to God, that the firstborn or the firstfruits, that they belonged to Him. And even though Isaac would have meant, in Abraham's mind, his line and his lineage and his descendants, he sees here that God is commanding something from him, commanding a sacrifice of them, and he's willing to trust it, even if it didn't make much sense. And we get further insight into this when we read through Hebrews chapter 11. Verse 17 says that by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. He who had received the promises was offering his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, "In Isaac your descendants shall be called." He considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. In other words, in a sense, he received Isaac back from the dead. I think when we see Abraham's response here, we're reminded that he's learning from his past. Just take a moment to think mentally, go on a mental journey through what we've seen Abraham go through at this point. Think of the way that God has called him out of where he was, that God has guided him, that when Abraham went into battle, God was with him and gave him victory. And even when it seemed impossible for him to have a child, God made that happen. And so as he is demanding from Abraham the child that he had given him, the Hebrews author tells us that in Abraham's mind, it made more sense to him that God could bring someone back from the dead than it did that God would take away the promise that he had promised for so long. In other words, how many times had he heard God say that Isaac would be the one through whom the descendants would become numerous? And so in Abraham's mind, there was some sort of trust and some sort of obedience that said there has to be a way that the God I am serving can make this right. We can read through the pages of Genesis, and we can look and we can search, but we won't find an example of resurrection from the dead, the way the Hebrews author describes it. And yet somehow Abraham knew that God must be able to work this out. He had learned from his past. He'd seen what happened when he hadn't trusted God. And so he trusted Him in something that would make no sense. And he did so with immediate obedience. He left the next day. That's in contrast to chapter 21, where he's fallen back into his own pattern of trying to cover himself and trying to lie about who Sarah is. Then you get to Genesis 22, and he's responding immediately. There's a phrase that's used in both Genesis 12 and Genesis 22. We see in Genesis 12 that God gives Abraham a command that begins with the same Hebrew structure there. It says, "Go forth." God wants him to go forth from his home, go forth from the land that he knows. And in chapter 22, verse 2, God says, "Go to the land of Moriah. Go to a place I will show you." In Genesis 12, "Go to a land I will show you." In Genesis 22, "Go to a place that I will show you." In Genesis 12, "I want you to sacrifice your past and put your past behind you." In Genesis 22, "I want you to give up your future." You see, Abraham was willing not only to learn from his past, but he was willing to sacrifice his future. He was willing to give that up in service to God, in understanding that God could work this out. He might be demanding something of me, and I can't understand it, but God will be able to work it out. It must be one of the hardest things we could imagine being asked. And yet we see this obedience here. It's interesting to me when Abraham describes what's going to take place with Isaac, and he's describing it to the servants. He says, "We're going to go over here, and we're going to worship." Do you know that's the first time we read the term worship there in the Old Testament? It tells us a lot about what worship is to God, doesn't it? It tells us that worship is offering up our best. And even in what must have been a gut-wrenching, emotional time for Abraham, he said, "God has asked me to do this, and I will, in offering this, I will worship Him. In doing this, that will be worship to God." Boy, that encourages us to take our worship seriously, doesn't it? To offer up something that's worthy of the God that we serve, that's our best, that's something that God has commanded us. There might be times it might not even feel good. There might be times we might be hurting, and yet Abraham said they were going to worship. They were going to give God what God had commanded. But he also said that they would return. And so that gives us insight into what Hebrews 11 tells us, that he had some kind of confidence that they would be able to come back. He learned from his past, and he was willing to give up his future. I wonder if we could say the same when it comes to our own tests of faith. Think for just a moment about the times that you've experienced some difficult tests in your faith. What can you learn from those? What can we take from those? Oftentimes we say experience is the best teacher, and it is if we're willing to learn from it. But if we don't learn from our experiences and we keep making the same mistakes over and over again, we're not going to make any progress. So I need to be able to think back in my life and say, have I learned from my past? Have I learned from what God has tried to teach me through these experiences I have? Have I processed those? Am I allowing those to equip me to handle future challenges? And am I willing to give up my future? In other words, am I willing to give up the future I might have mapped out for myself, that I might have planned out, and I think it's going to be a certain way, and I'm confident that this is what I'm going to need, and whether it's a specific job or whether it's a specific role that I need to play or a specific place that I need to live, am I willing to submit all of those things to the lordship of the one that I serve? Am I willing to say, I'll put that on the altar and you do what you will? It's a challenging thought, isn't it? It's hard to let go of our plans for the future. It's hard to let go of what we want for ourselves or for family members or for future plans. But are we willing to say to God that we'll put our future in His hands? Abraham had learned enough at this point. He was willing to do it because God had made the promise. And God was asking for the promise that He had made. But Abraham was willing to trust what God would do. You know, it's hard to think about the passage of a father and an only begotten son without letting our minds wander over to the New Testament. And traditionally, the area in which Abraham made this offering in the land of Moriah has been associated with Jerusalem. Now, recently, archaeologists have contested that, and so by no means is that an open and shut case. But even if we just think of that association, can't we just picture some of the animal sacrifices that would have been made from the temple and then the one who came so that there would be no more animal sacrifices? The only begotten Son of the Father that came. And when that sacrifice was made, there was nothing that stopped it. Because Jesus, as He lived on the earth, as He would tell Pilate, He was in control. Pilate wouldn't have any power except what was given to him. And that the hands were not stilled, that the sacrifice was not stopped. And in this case, there are eternal implications. It's powerful to think of the faith of Abraham, but even more powerful is to think of the gift that has been given to us as Christians, as we think about salvation, and the gift that's offered to everyone in the death and the burial and the resurrection of Jesus. It may be that you're here tonight, and you're in the middle of a test, and you're in the middle of something difficult. And I wish that I could say I have all the answers. I wish that we could look at our lives the way we can look at Abraham's life and read from the ending forward and kind of look back and see, okay, here's what's going to happen and here's why this needs to take place this way. And yet, we can't do that. We have a limited perspective. And so tonight, if you're struggling with something that's testing your faith, I wish I could tell you that I had all the answers to that or that one of us could explain it. We can't. What we can do is we can pray with you. We can go to the Father, the same God that Abraham served is the God that we served. We can walk alongside you through a difficult time. Or it may be that you're ready to take advantage of that sacrifice that was offered on the cross. And if you need to make that decision tonight, there's no better time to come forward and to put Christ on in baptism, to become a child of God. If we can help you in any way, please come as we stand, as we sing together.